When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to On the Continent, your definitive guide to the week in European football. I'm Dotson Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Nikki Bandini.
On this edition, how the mighty Juve have fallen down the Serie A table by 15 points in a week. Also, why the Bundesliga is scoring more goals per match than any other top league in Europe. And while the usual suspects are top of La Liga, as you'd expect, what about the drama at the other end of the league? I'm so glad you're here, Nikki, because we've been wondering about this Juve thing. You've been talking about it for ages. We knew that they were going to be punished in some way or other for their financial dealings. And here it is, 15-point deduction. How's that gone down in Italy?
Well, you say we knew they were going to be punished, Dotton, but I don't know if we did know that they were going to be punished. We knew there was a chance. And I would go as far as to say nobody knew they were going to be punished like this, because even within the context of the sporting trial that just took place last week, which had the verdict passed down on Friday, the prosecutor, the Italian Football Federation's prosecutor who was bringing charges against them, asked for a 9-point deduction. So the final decision exceeded what was asked for even by the prosecutor. And we're in this slight sort of mystery zone period right now, honestly, because the full verdict has to be published within 10 days of them releasing that judgment. And as of recording right now, it hasn't happened yet. We're recording, I suppose, 6 days after that verdict was passed. We've still got 4 more days to wait. And so even now, as I talk to you, there's still so much around this case that's sort of speculative because, yes, we know things that the prosecutor argued. We know some of the evidence that was brought against Juventus. We know the outline of what they're said to have done wrong, which, of course, always going to be worth stating in this case. Juventus do deny all charges and say they haven't done anything wrong. But the actual full details of what they have been officially punished for, we don't know yet.
Do we know why they were brought into court in the first place? What's the background to this story?
Yeah, and this is where it gets wordy. So essentially, this all goes back to a case that in Italy has been referred to as the Pus Valenza case. Pus Valenza means capital gains. And it's all about clubs, not just Juventus in the first instance, who were charged on it, using creative financial mechanisms to inflate their accounts. And the most sort of core part of this is teams swapping players, doing exchange deals, and placing artificially high values, or at least what look like artificially high values on their players.
So I guess the most obvious one of those would be Artur Melo coming from Barcelona for, what, 70 million euros. Miralem Pjanic going for 60 in the opposite direction. Very little money actually changing hands. But Juventus, for example, being able to have that 71, 72 million euros spread over like 5 years of Artur's contract, so it doesn't put too much on FFP, and yet being able to bank, in inverted commas, all the Pjanic money straight away.
Yeah, and I feel like this is an era in which we've expected football fans to become accountants and to understand this concept of amortization, which is what you just sort of hinted at there, Andy. When you sign a player now, and every football club does this, this is not unique to Juventus, this is completely common practice. In fact, it's now becoming a talking point again for Chelsea because of the Mudryk deal and FIFA saying, well, actually, maybe you can't do it over a contract that long. But it's standard practice too. If you sign a player for 70 million euros, as we say in this case, and their contract is 5 years, instead of putting on your accounts this year, we spent 70 million euros, you divide the 70 million by five, and that's how much you put down for this year. And then you put the same amount next year and so on until the end of the contract. However, when you sell a player, you put that revenue on right away. So in the Melo Pjanic exchange is a good example. Juventus get to write in what they've made selling Pjanic right away, whereas the cost of Melo is spread over 5 years. So on this year's accounts, that's a profit, even if it's a completely sort of no money changing hands deal, that's a profit on the accounts. So that mechanism is common and used everywhere. And in the initial Pus Valenza case, 11 clubs in Italy were charged and accused of essentially putting false values on players in these transfers. And in the initial case last year, the Italian Football Federation had a hearing, looked at it and said, sort of threw their arms up and said, okay, sure, but who can say how much a player is worth? Because football transfers are completely sort of beauty in the eye of the beholder. All the time you get players who cost a lot of money who don't work out. You can't put an objective value on a player. So they threw the case out. Then separate to this, there's been an investigation in Turin called the Prisma investigation, which is the Turin public prosecutor, nothing to do with football, investigating Juventus accounts because effectively they've been accused of misleading the stock market. Not effectively, that is what they've been accused of, is misleading the stock market.
And that's a different jurisdiction now, because you're going beyond footballing authorities. Yeah,
this is a criminal investigation. And misleading the stock market is, you know, a big case that may draw in some of this this Plus Valenza stuff. The bigger element for them was actually about a wage deferral, which is Juventus sort of very publicly during the COVID pandemic said their players had agreed to give up 4 months worth of wages because the club's financial situation needed it. And then the accusation against them, and this is a court case that will begin in March, is that actually the players did not give up that much wages because it was paid back to them in bonuses, which were guaranteed bonuses. So it was sort of said to them, look, you give up 4 months wages, but either you get this loyalty bonus for staying or you get this golden handshake for leaving. And so you're getting this money back. Not all of it, but maybe 3 months worth of it.
Do you mind me just cutting to the chase? How much do they owe Cristiano Ronaldo?
Well, Cristiano Ronaldo is a fascinating sort of subplot in all this because his... I'll get to it in just a second. I feel like I need to keep going with the Prisma bit first. So Prisma investigation by the Turin public prosecutor found all sorts of interesting things. They conducted wiretaps, they conducted interceptions of communications, and among their findings were various things that related to the capital gains case, the Plus Valenza case. But they also, in the wages case, have turned up all sorts of interesting documents, including this apparent side letter, which is sort of several players are accused of signing. I mean, this is all to go to an official court case, so I feel like I have to keep everything in the terms of allegedly. But there is apparently this side letter which a number of players have signed, which allegedly basically says, yes, we understand we're getting our money back, or at least some of it, not the full 4 months, but some of this money's coming back to us. But not all players signed it, and Ronaldo is among the players who didn't sign it. So is Kulusevski, by the way, apparently. And this actually has real implications for the players, because now one of the many threads that's come out of this is there is a risk that players who agreed to this mechanism could serve suspensions themselves. They could be banned from football for a while because you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to participate in this sort of, I suppose what looks like almost like a charade of saying we're going to give up wages and not doing it. So Ronaldo's lawyers actually have sort of asked to see some of this documentation. They've said, this is interesting stuff. We'd like to see this because we didn't get this money back. And it was everyone else getting this money back? So that's a whole separate side case going on. And I'm sure no one is going to cry for Ronaldo and his money. But that you named Ronaldo, and there's a whole separate story with Ronaldo, I suppose.
There's so many probables and possibles with this, yes. And we'll try and avoid speculation as much as possible. But what does it do for Serie A at the moment where we are? Mm. Because clearly Napoli is streaking away at the top of the table. I think we might mention Napoli again in a minute. Mm. But Juventus were looking good, if not to push them on the back of the 5-1 defeat recently, certainly for a Champions League place, which would have been a minimum for them. Now, all of a sudden, they're catapulted into mid-table. I mean, there was this kind of air of defiance, wasn't there, in Turin around the game on Sunday. It was really entertaining 3-3 draw with Atalanta, and Ademola Lookman was brilliant again in that, yeah. Wasn't he? 11 goals this season. But what is the feeling? Because Allegri has kind of changed his language, hasn't he? He said, well, nothing changes. We carry on. We're still going for Europe. I noticed he said Europe, not Champions League.
Yeah. Mm.
Who immediately, assuming things stay like they are, and that's a big assumption for the moment, but we can only judge things on how they are right now, who benefits from this? Is it Roma? Is it Lazio?
Yeah, so yeah, just to sort of clarify that, I suppose 15 points have been given right now as a points penalty, which they are going to appeal. But for right now in the standings, it's dropped them all the way down into mid-table. And it's certainly thrown the Champions League race, as it looks right now, into something hugely fascinating, actually coupled with the fact that both Milan clubs suddenly seem to have lost their way, because both of them lost in the last, not even over the weekend because they spilled into this week, but in the last few days. And so, yeah, you have within a very small number of points, you have everyone from Milan and Inter down to Roma, Lazio and now Atalanta as well. So the Champions League race has become extremely interesting. Max Allegri, the Juventus manager, is sort of famous in Italy for his points calculations. One of his sort of his tropes almost is he's always like, oh, well, you need this number of points. And he was saying after the Atlanta game, well, you know, 70 points will get you into the Champions League. So actually he did talk about the Champions League and we can still get there, but you have to go on this sort of run. And they have gone on runs before. And what was fascinating about the game against Atlanta, Andy, is, you know, it was probably the most open attacking game of football that I've seen Juventus play all season.
Yeah.
Perhaps forced on them because that's how Atalanta play, and Atalanta have a way of turning games to their sorts of games, and because Atalanta scored first.
So did it not feel a product of the situation?
But that's what I was going to say is I almost felt like with their backs to the wall, we saw the best Juventus we've seen all season. Maybe right. Maybe they still had flaws because they conceded goals.
Yeah.
But they, going forward, they were brilliant at times in this game. I mean, Di Maria, I think probably for the first time this season, it felt like he was really present, because before the World Cup, he was injured a lot. But with hindsight, you definitely think, how much was he also managing those injuries with a big eye on, I want to go to Qatar as best I can. But he was really sort of wonderful going forward. Arkadiusz Milik, who's having quietly a very good season for them, scores a superb volley. You've obviously got Federico Chiesa coming back from injury. He's already been playing, but there was this sort of really thrilling energy about watching them play. And even the last equaliser they got, where it's Di Maria feigning the free kick and then rolling it under his boot for Danilo.
And Danilo's been one of their stars of the season, hasn't he?
Yeah, and he does this daisy cutter under the wall. I thought all of their goals were just brilliant. And in the end, it still didn't get them 3 points because, as you said, Atalanta and Ademola Lookman have also been brilliant.
Well, as Andy said a moment ago, you know, this whole court case and the deduction of the points is like lobbing a grenade. You didn't quite say it in those words, but you've lobbed a grenade into Serie A and there are consequences. Lovable Scamp on Instagram has sent us a message, which is that with Juve out of the equation now, who in Serie A gets Champions League? Can Roma do it?
If there's a point that you're going to be convinced by Roma, I think this is possibly it. Mm. Because to me, at the moment, they're playing like a good Mourinho team. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. They manage games well. They suck the joy out of games quite well. They knock the goals off when they need to. But you get the sense they're playing a little bit within themselves. Now, I feel they're defending very, very well collectively at the moment. I think the win at Spezia at the weekend, which was a really difficult game. Spezia hadn't lost. Spezia were at home. They hadn't lost since the resumption of Serie A. They made it tough for Roma at times. But Roma managed it expertly. They defended really well. Rui Patricio didn't really have to make that many saves, even though they were under the pump at various points. The only caveat I have to that, Nicky, is the reason they're able to actually win those games rather than draw them at the moment is the ultimate footballing, European footballing bromance at the moment between Tammy Abraham and Paulo Dybala, who are really clicking. And them clicking and Abraham playing well again, not just scoring, but playing well again, elevating them to a different level. So for me, it feels like, yeah, they could finish in the top four, but a hell of a lot depends on where Dybala is physically.
Yeah, I find Roma fascinating because I've also sort of heard people ask me, oh, aren't people in Rome sick of Mourinho yet? And the truth is, Roma fans adore him still, absolutely.
Look at those full stands.
Yeah, can do no wrong, exactly. That's a really relevant part of it, I think, Andy. Like, they're selling out all the time, which they didn't do for a long time. And actually, even before this sort of start of the year, which has gone positively, if you dig into the data, their expected goals for and against, they had sort of the biggest negative gap between where they should be and where they were. Like, they had good expected goals against, and they hadn't quite hit it. And part of that, I'm sorry to say, was actually because Tammy Abraham started the season in bad form. Abraham, who was really sort of prolific last season, wasn't scoring at the start of the season. And I think you're exactly right that when Dybala's on the pitch with him, the energy changes. And you've got two players who, look, I'm always the first person to defend Serie A. I'm always the first person to talk it up. But Serie A has overall certainly that the standard isn't where it was in the 90s. You can say that. And they are two of the standout players in terms of individual quality. I think they're two players who at least certainly can stand out. And Dybala has been the league's most valuable player before. And so when you get two really top-notch players vibing with each other and enjoying each other, it becomes really transformative. Now, the problem with that is, what it's always been for Dybala, he's injured a lot. And so will he be healthy till the end of the season? Who knows? And to sort of re-emphasize, I suppose, where we started this conversation and the potential for ripple effects, could even he be drawn into that case with the wage issue? Because he was at Juventus at the time when that happened. His name has been mentioned as one of those, and in theory, could be at risk of a suspension. Now, again, of course, that case of the wages hits the legal system at the end of March, so we're talking late in the season, but who knows? And one of the many, many unknowables for us at the moment with this case.
Yeah, 20 players, apparently, could be dragged into this. How do you sing happy birthday in Italian?
So normally it's tanti auguri, which is actually sort of best wishes, I guess, rather than happy birthday, but that's the standard.
Can we do it to our tune?
Tanti auguri a te, tanti auguri a te. Who we sing it to?
Oh,
Jose,
come on.
Mourinho!
Tanti auguri, caro Jose. Tanti auguri a te.
Yeah, happy 60th birthday to Jose. This other question, though. Is it going to get worse for Juve? Ask Sepoussin on Instagram. And I had to say Juve because I couldn't pronounce Sepoussin.
Is it going to get worse for them? I think this wage case is a big one. Of course, you know, if they are found to have misled the stock market, that has sort of real world outside of football implications with criminal charges. Obviously, the whole board has changed, so individuals may already have left the club who get punished, but the club will certainly face further sporting penalties if that case is proven. There's been suggestions in the press of, oh, it could be another 15-point penalty. And I think, honestly, that's where we're dipping a bit too far into conjecture because nobody expected this 15-point penalty. Who knows what penalty that could be, but there certainly would be sporting ramifications for them. If that happens, it's also worth saying again, as I said at the beginning, they deny the charges. They're appealing them to the Italian Olympic Committee. The Italian Olympic Committee does not have the power to look at the merits of the case, but they do have the power to look at the process. And therefore, if the Italian Olympic Committee upholds their appeal, which...
Italian Olympic Committee?
I know it sounds odd, but that's the standard sort of highest body of sort of sporting authority in Italy. They have a board of guarantors, and if they find that the Italian Football Federation didn't follow due process, and Juventus will argue, among other things, that this is double jeopardy, we've already been tried on this case, you can't try us twice. If they win that argument, that case, that the 15-point penalty they have now could be vacated. So anything could happen in this case, honestly, but certainly Juventus have a lot more scary dates coming up in the calendar.
So without talking too much about the potential ripple effect, you know, there is. If there are swap deals, you know, and this could move across Europe, couldn't it? Because, you know, we're talking about transactions between two compliant clubs. That's what we're talking about. The thing that really interests me is one of the cases that was examined in the original proceedings that were shelved last April. And he's one of the most high-profile players in Serie A, playing for the league leaders, the top scorer, Victor Osimhen, who ended up going from Lille to Napoli for, what, 50-plus million cash, plus some players of... If we're talking of Plus Valenza, I mean, this seems to be one of the clearest examples of it. David talked about it on the Ramble earlier in the week. Where are we at with this? Would the FIGC and their prosecutor like to look at this again?
Yeah, so the prosecutor, Giuseppe Chiné, has actually, in the last few days, asked for information from the public prosecutor in Naples from, again, a separate, completely separate criminal proceeding, which was a fraud investigation into the Napoli president, Aurelio De Laurentiis.
Right.
So they've asked for evidence. If there's a, basically they've contacted the Naples prosecutor and said, is there anything that we should be looking at? And I think this cuts to a really sort of fascinating part of the Juventus case that we're all waiting on with this verdict. What is it that's specific in this Juventus finding that the Italian Football Federation have punished them for? We've all heard the arguments that they've these wiretaps sound damning. We've heard directors saying things about all the shit that's underneath in our finances, saying we've pushed this mechanism too far. We've heard things that sound damning. But what specifically has the Football Federation laid down as its basis for this judgment? Because a lot of the reporting around this case, certainly Gazzetta dello Sport, the morning after, was talking about, well, actually, you know, what Juventus did wrong here was, it's not they did something that no one else is doing, but they made it into a whole system. And that raises this sort of awkward question of, well, how do you lay that down in law? You know, to draw an extreme, slightly sort of ridiculous parallel, but I think maybe an illustrative one is it okay to kill one person as long as you don't kill 10 people? That's the question we're all asking. And this Osimhen case looks very questionable because four players went to Lille who are not players, but most of them even played for Lille.
Well, we talked about it earlier, didn't we, off mic? And yeah. we could only think of one of them, couldn't we?
Yeah, and Canessis played maybe once for Lille. Barely played. Older goalkeeper. So 20 million in value seems ridiculous. But then we're back to the very start of this conversation. The first appeal, the first charges that were brought in Italy in the Plus Valenza case, you can't set an objective value on a footballer. People will pay what they want. So on what basis were the Juventus prosecuted successfully? And could that be a basis for someone else you prosecuted? That's what we're waiting to find out.
Look, clearly, we're going to hear more about this. It ain't done yet. We're hearing about all sorts of issues with regards to Chelsea now and the way that they offer contracts over a longer period so as to not pile all the sort of expense on one season. It does feel as if European football is going to feel the impact of what's going on in Italy.
I think it's such a fascinating big question of what could happen. I mean, I do think at the moment, with what we know so far, if there is one thing that Juventus are justified to feel in all of this, it's, I mean, any of these deals take two to tango. You cannot do this on your own. So have other clubs been doing things that are similar? Yes. What could be sort of interpreted as precedent by other countries, by UEFA, by FIFA? Huge open questions with implications for lots of clubs all over Europe.
Yeah, I mean, look, I never want to assume what our listeners are thinking, but I know a lot of them will be thinking Barcelona at this very moment, because clearly they have had to be creative in allowing themselves the latitude to sign a lot of players in the last year and a bit since Xabi has become coach. Again, I don't think they're alone in that by any stretch of the imagination, but I think because football is such a pan-European community in the sense that we're talking about it, and you know, the biggest transfers in Europe are part of such a pan-European community. This doesn't exist in a bubble. I'm very interested to see the way it goes. And of course, clubs have felt they've had to be more creative because of financial fair play over the last little while. Now, the fact is, FFP has had a mini holiday because of COVID, but there's going to come that bit where UEFA are going to want to come back on it. Now, I think the really interesting question is, once we get to the other side of this Juventus verdict, once we've got reasons, once we've got precedent, once we've got their grounds for appeal and all that sort of stuff, do UEFA really want to stick the boot in on Juventus? Or do they think, well, Agnelli's not there anymore, maybe it doesn't matter to us to the same extent? Because remember, he was one of the not just someone who was the architect of modern Juventus, but one of the would-be architects of the European Super League.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Let's talk about the Bundesliga now. Gosh, it's back and on good form. It's firing much more than any of the other leagues in Europe. Is it the most exciting league in Europe at the moment?
I guess there's a difference between exciting and satisfying, really, isn't there?
There is.
Because on the first weekend back, last weekend, we got 41 goals across the nine games, which is pretty remarkable. It was especially
it's
remarkable.
Five goals per game or something.
You're in charge of the maths on this, not me.
Not actually, you don't want to rely on me.
But I thought we'd left the maths questions in section one. But I think it was particularly remarkable given that the first game between Leipzig and Bayern, arguably the two best teams in the division, on the Friday night that re-kicked off the Bundesliga, it was a 1-1 draw, and it felt as if both teams were keeping a respectful distance, sizing each other up. And then you get to the next day. You get Köln 7, Werder Bremen 1. You get Wolfsburg 6, Freiburg, who was second at the start of 2023, 0. So you get something quite remarkable. And then on the Sunday, the first game, you get what? Let me work this out. You get 12 goals in the two games. Between Dortmund and Augsburg and Borussia Mönchengladbach and Bayer Leverkusen. But the Dortmund one, I think, is worth focusing on because we've since had a round of midweek matches in the Bundesliga. Dortmund have two wins out of two. You had the 4-3 win over Augsburg where they basically had to win the game four times because of their incredibly incompetent defending. And then Gio Reyna gets a late-ish winner in that. It gets an even later winner in the weekend against Mainz. They go goal down after 2 minutes, don't play particularly well, and somehow manage to win the game. Now, I think there's a difference between those two games. The main one, being the first one, has got Jude Bellingham in it, and he absolutely runs the show. So the attacking part of Dortmund is a lot more functional. At the start of the season, they bring in Salih Özcan, defensive midfielder from Köln, because they think with a proper anchor, you can let Bellingham off the leash. You can give him license to do whatever he wants. And we saw during the World Cup how incredibly dangerous he is. And we saw that against Augsburg last weekend. He was brilliant. Scored the opening goal. Set up Reina's winner with an incredible reverse pass. It looked brilliant. And he was suspended after getting a fifth booking in that game for the Mainz game. And it's all a little bit more clunky and laboured. But I think probably what you're asking here is, where is the pattern? The thing is, there is no pattern. It's all just incredibly chaotic from the team, Nicky, who should be best equipped to challenge Bayern.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And I wonder how that affects sort of the development of a young player like Bellingham, because I think there are some players who thrive in chaos. It's something I've sort of said actually about Weston McKennie at Juventus. Sometimes I watch him, I think he's what Americans would call a sandlot player. He's someone who just sort of like, actually, I think he does his best when everything breaks down, because he's got that energy and I guess initiative is the word I'm looking for, where someone who's willing to take things on when it breaks down.
You're right. I mean, I think the fact that Bellingham is a really good leader, is still a teenager, he's not 20 until June, of course, is really underlined by the fact that everything around him is like a little bit crazy.
Yeah, and I think like there's a certain sort of energy that some players have. I would say Wayne Rooney had this as well when he was younger, and when he was sort of at his best, there's a sort of bullish willingness to just say, well, if you guys don't know what you're going to do, I'm going to do my thing, and you're going to dance to my tune. And I suppose
he's able to do that in Germany in a way that he perhaps isn't able to do in other leagues, I'd have thought. Jude Bellingham, if we're doing that.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of thriving in the chaos that suggests that he would be one of the best players in the Premier League.
No, I don't
think that's overstating it.
I don't doubt that, and apologies for interrupting you.
That's all right. But
I was thinking more about the sort of chaos of the league as such, you know, where you have Bayern Munich, you know, at a point where they should be seriously challenged by Dortmund and the other contenders. They're not being. So there's a certain amount of chaos in that league.
I think it's interesting going back to that point of like Bayern not really being challenged. I mean, I think you look at the table and you think other teams are in it. Union Berlin, who are, on the other hand, exceptionally well managed and organised, are doing very well. Dortmund in fifth place are only 5 points behind Bayern. So it probably doesn't seem in a statistical sense that they're out of touch. That they are. You know, these teams are not going to catch Bayern, despite the fact that Bayern have dropped 4 points in these first two games. They needed an absolute rocket shot, brilliant goal from Joshua Kimmich to save a point against Köln on Tuesday. And what really struck me in the time around that, like Kimmich said, we lacked focus and intensity. They actually played pretty well in the second half of that, I would say. But it's felt to me, when you've had Hasan Salihamidzic, the sporting director of Bayern, talking in the last couple of days, it feels like he's trying to provoke. Like, he slagged off Serge Gnabry for going to Paris Fashion Week. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, it's ridiculous. It's totally unprofessional. It's like, he's having a day off. I think he's allowed to do what he likes on a day off. And Salihamidzic's view was, oh, well, we didn't win. And, you have to recover after a game rather than dashing away. Like, Munich to Paris is not like going from London to Sydney. Mm. I think, you know, it's a very subjective way of looking at the situation. It feels to me like he's trying to pick a fight so they don't get complacent. Mm. Because at the moment, despite the fact there are goals everywhere, in fact, probably because there are loads of goals,
3.3
everywhere else.
3.3 per game.
It's a lot.
I had to work out the maths.
It feels like they have to say to themselves, like, come on, let's get it together and go and win this league by 10 points, which still to me feels like an inevitability.
I want to ask Andy, if you're talking about lots of goals and you're talking about the gaps and them not being run down. Am I crazy to think that Wolfsburg could get to them? Because it's only 7 points the gap. And Wolfsburg aren't just winning games. Maybe I'm throwing a team out of nowhere, but like they won two games in the last 4 days, 11-0? And they've scored 22 goals across the last six games.
Well, firstly, can I just say I appreciate the Guardian columnist solidarity, because I've actually written about them for my midweek. It's a surprise. Yeah.
The Wolfsburg is happening? That's a question from Thomas.
It's a really good question, I think, from Nicky and Thomas, because they started the season really badly. Niko Kovac takes over after the shambles, really, that was last season. And they win one of the first seven games and they lose four of them. And people are calling for Kovac to be binned off after that start to the season. Bearing in mind that the start to last season, Mark van Bommel brought on, in his debut as Wolfsburg coach, a sub too many in a cup match, and they got thrown out of the cup. So, I mean, I don't think it's as bad as all that. But Kovac is nothing if not resourceful and tough and very demanding. He's had to deal with other situations. Like, he fell out with Max Kruse, and he was never going to get on with Max Kruse, because Max Kruse is about the magic, not about the fitness. Kovac really is about the fitness. He wants his team to be, you know, whip it ready. And he just very publicly binned him, not from the team, from the entire squad, and says, you have nothing to do with this squad now. And, you know, Kruse is not one to take that line down. He's not one to be quiet. And Kovac knew that, but he dealt with it. Now, you think, they haven't lost since September. As Nicky says, 6 wins in a row. They've not conceded in 5 of those. In the 2 games since they've been back, 11 goals scored, none conceded. And beating Freiburg was a brilliant performance. They went and won 5-0 at Hertha on Wednesday night, which, that's a little different, because Hertha are absolutely dreadful at the moment. But what I think is really notable, if you go back to the last good Wolfsburg team, you've got a really real focal point up front and a really consistent goal scorer in Val Veghorst, excuse me, who doesn't need a lot of chances to score goals. They don't really have that at the moment, especially as Lucas Metcher, the older of the Metcher brothers who were produced by Manchester City's academy, he's been injured since November. He would have gone to the World Cup with Germany otherwise. And he's potentially a really good number 9 for them, 9/10. So they've had to spread the goals around. They're really, really resourceful. But they've got great experience as well. You think of...
It's a player I really want to ask about.
Please, go on.
Because you're talking about the goals. I know they've got, obviously, like, it's Wind, isn't it? The teenager up front who's got Sam. Vin, sorry. But I'm really interested in this Patrick Wimmer, who... is what, 21 years old, and I saw across Europe's big 5 leagues the this is big chance creation per opta, but the out of players with 500 plus minutes, is one of only sort of 3 players in all of Europe's big 5 leagues to create more than one big chance per game. It's him, Kevin De Bruyne, and Leo Messi, which is some company to be keeping
in that order. In that order,
yes.
And the assist he gave to Vind on the other day, where he does this sort of Rabona flick from the edge of the area, was outrageous. So
he's doing really, really well. Only 21 years old, and it's funny, that stat was something. I don't know if you were at Wolfsburg's team lunch before the Hertha game, but all the players were ragging him about that at lunch. And then, of course, he goes on and lays on the opening goal in that game, having got everything started by scoring a goal in 59 seconds against Freiburg. And I think they've got that really good mix at the moment. And Kovac is really good at drilling teams. But I think you look at the experience they've got with... Cohen Castells, with Maxi Arnold, who's still brilliant. I think people expected him to go to a higher level, a bigger club, and be one of the real stars of German football. But, you know, he's going to go on and become their record appearance holder probably in the next month and a half. And Joshua Gilavogi, who wants to go to Stuttgart, they're not letting him go because Kovac is like, well, look, I'm not a genie. I don't have to make people's wishes come true. We need to keep you. You're important to us. And I think it's interesting because Gilavogi, Castells and Arnold are 3 of their top 10 appearance makers of all time. So you've got that experience. And then you've got the younger players like Wimmer and like the Metcher brothers, who look as if they're going to go and do something in the future. That's why I think it's interesting them going and smacking Hertha like that, because they've been in Hertha's place, like spending a load of money, having absolutely no direction and idea. Whereas now they're being a little bit more reserved, sensible. When they're stable, they're much better. And I think that makes the difference. But it's the best run that they've had in the Bundesliga, those 6 wins in a row, since they won 10 in a row in the spring. And you were saying about them challenging Bayern, Nicky, when they went on to win the Bundesliga in 2009, when they had Edin Dzeko and Gudafice up front.
Andy, you've coined this word, goalmongers. I've searched in the dictionary, it's not there, but it's not a bad word.
It will be.
Eventually it will be. But is this goal fest, if you like, for want of a better word, is it indicative of the weaker competition that Bayern are facing in the Bundesliga, would you say, Nikki?
I think it's complicated, isn't it? I think because I know this is something that Andy was sort of asking before on the chat, you know, is Serie A being more goals scored doesn't necessarily mean a weaker league, and it doesn't necessarily mean a weaker league. So goals can go up and go and come down without meaning anything. I think maybe it wouldn't be outrageous to suggest that the defending in the Bundesliga isn't always brilliant at the moment, but that doesn't make it less entertaining outrageous. To watch.
Let's have a look at La Liga now, where, as you would expect, the usual suspects are at the top of the league. Barcelona at the top, followed by Real Madrid. So what's new? Let's have a look instead, though, at the other end of La Liga. And, of course, Sevilla featured in our Game of the Week last week. You must remember my Lord Byron anecdotes with that. And Cadiz lost that matchup, so they're rock bottom. But Sevilla potentially doing a bit better?
Well, it's a really good question, I think, because two home wins in a row for Sevilla against Getafe and Cadiz. And you're right, that they really pulled this one out of the fire right at the end. Ivan Rakitic penalty coming into the last minute. But they've looked so nervous in both those teams, in both those games. And what that says to me is one of Sevilla's biggest problems, and my gosh, they have got a lot of problems, because bear in mind, at this point last season, they were signing Anthony Martial on loan from Manchester United with a view to really pushing Real Madrid for the league. That's how far they have fallen.
And they were reliant on Anthony Martial.
In that time, and it didn't work.
Of course
it didn't work. He didn't score a single goal.
Mm.
But, I mean, there were other issues with them. I guess a lot of people didn't realise exactly how deep those issues were. And you look at them now, I think the biggest problem, as we were saying, as they try and battle relegation, and they are in a genuine relegation fight, there's no doubt about that, has been shown in those last two games. Because, as we've said, that they have got 6 points from those last two home games in La Liga, but they do not look like a team that's got that much resolve. They're just not built for a relegation battle. The squad has not been built for a relegation battle. So they're not only in an unfavourable situation, they're in an unfavourable situation that you could argue that this current set of players are not really equipped to deal with. Now, I suspect that a huge part of that is why Jorge Sampaoli has been strongly rumoured to be considering jacking it in again already around Seville and in the local media there. And when we look at Monchi, and I'm really interested, Nicky, to get an Italian perspective on him. Monchi has had, in his first spell at Sevilla, had extremely successful periods and fallow periods. This could be the fallow period to end them all, because the sort of players they've gone around and signed, I mean, you look at the start of the season and it felt like they had a very young defence and a very old forward line, which is really the reverse of what you want. And you look at some of those big signings that have been made that haven't really come off. Rakitic, okay, he cares, but he's past his best. Isco, a deal that went so badly that and was not cheap in wages, by the way, that they've already binned him off. They've cancelled his contract less than 6 months into it. Where is Monchi at? And do you think he's still affected by the Roma experience?
Yeah, it definitely felt like his time at Roma was perceived as more bad than good. I don't think it was sort of perceived as without merits at all. Because
do you think he was made to carry the can for a lot of the stuff that was wrong on his way out the door?
Yeah, I mean, I think Roma sort of went through quite a long period of feeling a bit rudderless, and I think that's one of the many reasons why Mourinho is so popular now, is sort of this force of character to bring everything together again.
Yeah.
Not that things weren't already going better under Fonseca, because they were. But he did have some pretty big missteps. I mean, he was the one who signed to Javier Pastore to a big contract that got sort of became a big millstone around the club for a while. Alisson goes out the door and Robin Olsen gets brought in, who ends up being this horrendously sort of error-prone keeper. There were quite a few signings that even ones that people were quite excited about that didn't really pan out, just in Kluivert, be another one. And yet there were also some things he did that were considered at the time to be massive coup. I mean, he sent Rajanangalan, aged mid-30s, out the door to Inter and got Nicolò Zaniolo, this great sort of future talent, in the opposite direction. And Zaniolo's his own story that we could get into, but certainly that was a really sort of smart piece of business for the sort of long-term planning point of view. So I think he left a mixed legacy at Roma, but certainly when he arrived, there was this perception of, oh, we've got the transfer wizard. We've got the guy who knows how to do all the best deals in Europe. And I think that sheen came off a little bit then, certainly.
Yeah, the stats don't lie, do they? Oh, sometimes they do, but nevertheless, 18 points out of 18 games this season. Only the fourth victory for Sevilla compared with 38 points from 18 games last season.
He's been halfway getting through. Some sort of kickback on his behaviour as well, hasn't he, Monchi?
Monchi.
From sort of going down to the touchline and berating referees and being a bit more...
Yeah, it's like Jorge Valdano meltdown era at Real Madrid a little bit. And I think it's indicative of the sort of status he has at the club, because of course he was there for 20 years before going in the first place, that he feels he has to lead from the front. I mean, when Julen Lopetegui was in the process of being binned earlier in the season, it was him who went down on the pitch and presented him to the fans at full time to say, you know, this is your guy. Man. And even though he's going, let's give him respect for what he's actually done from the club, which almost again was an admission of his own failure. I mean, I wonder if this needed to be a slightly busier transfer window for Sevilla to get themselves into a position where they were safe. Look, they've got the players to get out of it, but I think they'll be struggling for a bit more before they do get out of it. I don't think it's an open and shut case by any stretch of the imagination in terms of them getting away from relegation.
And it's not a shut transfer window just yet.
No, it's not.
Not just yet. Before we get onto the game of the week, though, there's a great question here from Jack. And by the way, we do love your correspondence. So you can get hold of us on social media anytime during the course of the week at Football Ramble, at Dotton Adebayo, at Nikki Bandini, and at Andy Brassel. This from Jack. Do you have suggestions for a team to watch on a weekend with friends? Can be anywhere in Europe. Fascinating question, because everybody, you know, loves European football, but who do you follow? How do you get passionate? What would you recommend, Nikki?
Oh, it's such a difficult question, because, like, what are you looking for? Are you looking for a fun weekend trip? Because I always tell everyone to go to Bologna and watch a game, because I love the stadium and I love the city. I think it's a wonderful place to go and eat for a weekend. Like, you'll have a good time. Right now, Bologna are a mid-table side who aren't necessarily the most sort of brilliant to watch in all of Serie A.
Well, that's what you want, isn't it? You want mid-table, don't you? Because you don't have to invest as much emotion and passion. No, that's what you want.
No, but it's about the all-round experience, definitely. Yeah. I mean, straight away, I always say Marseille first. For the atmosphere, for the buzz of the city. We've just been talking about Sevilla, haven't we? Sevilla or Betis. I mean, it's an incredible city, great food. And you know what? Even if the football is not the best at Sevilla at the moment, whichever game you go to, it doesn't even have to be a big game. The bit where they play the anthem at the beginning and then they kill the music and the fans carry on singing it. I mean, the game doesn't even matter after that. It's amazing.
I think for the same reason, almost off the back of that, and teams we've just been talking about right now, go watch Roma in a full stadium. Because the Stadio Olimpico, when it's full, when it's on, is one of those stadiums that can really, like, I think it's shockingly loud when it's full. I remember watching the second leg of their Champions League semi-final against Liverpool, and sat next to Andy Hunter from The Guardian, who has covered Liverpool for many, many years. And of course, Liverpool thumped him in the leg at Anfield, and him turning to me and saying, God, this is even louder than Anfield. And I thought, that's something to hear from someone who is a correspondent who covers Liverpool. So Rome, when it's like this, when it's on, is somewhere special to watch a game as well.
But it's all of it, isn't it? It's the walk up to the stadium when you're going amongst the sort of stone gladiators and all the rest of it. It's brilliant.
May I recommend Hammarby in Stockholm?
That's a great choice. South,
absolutely. I mean, you wait till you hear the anthem. When they start singing that, the hairs on the back of your neck go up. You know, just today I am strong, which was an anthem to die for, really. It's Söder Stadium in Stockholm as well. Green and whites, green and whites. Make sure you wear green. So, a football game of the week recommendation from both of you. Do you have one?
Yeah, I guess I'll go straight back to Roma again. Napoli-Roma on Sunday night is the game of the week in Serie A. It's a huge game. Roma, as we've been talking about, are playing really well at the moment. They're fighting for a Champions League place. Napoli, of course, running away with things at the top of Serie A. The last sort of big challenge they were supposed to face was Juventus, and they beat them 5-1. So either it'll be a repeat of just being starstruck by how good they are, or maybe Roma with their sort of not always the most sort of expansive game plan, but maybe the canniness of them can throw a spanner in the works for Napoli.
What would Mr. Mourinho suggest as a food pairing? Something to eat during the halftime?
Well, birthday cake, evidently.
Well, yeah, obviously.
I don't know what shows they would eat. I'm now thinking about the sort of carefully curated social media pictures of him sort of sat on the floor eating out of a box after games. But honestly, what was in my head for this game, because I knew you were going to ask me, and I think this is not necessarily really even a Sunday night meal for most people in Italy, but I was thinking Sunday night, when I'm going to be at home wanting to watch the game and it's cold outside, frittata di macaroni, which is just frying up pasta with an egg to make it into a frittata, basically. Very Neapolitan, traditional thing to have. And it's a great way to get rid of all your bits of pasta at the end of a bag where you haven't got quite enough for a proper pasta dish. You throw it together and you fry it up, and it's a nice, hearty, warm winter meal.
You're going to have to work hard to beat that one, because that's easy to make.
I'm still shocked that we didn't get a Neapolitan pizza. Carlo Ancelotti would be disgusted.
I feel like I've done that before.
Yeah, for a reason. Okay. It keeps getting done again for a reason.
Do it again and again.
Never a bad choice.
Fair point.
I'm going to go for Sunday night. Portuguese League Cup, Taça da Liga final between Sporting and Porto. Now, this is often the final
of the
Taça da Liga. It's the fourth consecutive final that Sporting have been in. They're already out of the title race. They are it's looking hard for them in the Champions League race, because Braga are playing so well at the moment, and their star Vitinha are playing so well at the moment as well. So it feels like more is riding on this for Sporting than Porto from the outside. However, Sergio Conceição, the fact they couldn't win this cup has done his head in so much, he actually offered to resign after they lost one of the finals to Sporting on penalties. So this means a hell of a lot to him as well. He's a combustible guy. It's the climax of the way they play the Taça da Liga is like a Final Four, where they play in one venue, they play semi-finals on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then final at the weekend, which I particularly like. I think it's a really good way of regenerating a competition that, you know, the League Cup has been marginalised, or in the case of France, actually binned off as well, when we have thicker and thicker schedules all the time. But I think this will be super worth watching. Also, for Spurs fans who are hoping that Sporting sign Pedro Porro to fill up their problem position of right wing back. The latest talk in Portugal as we go to air is, as we record, is that he will be allowed to play this one last game and go out in style before he goes to N17. So a lot going on there. I think for a big game, you got to have a big meal. Go for bacalhau à brás. I don't know how to make it. Deliveroo it. Obviously, there are 400 different ways of doing bacalhau, salted cod, in Portugal. This, in my view, is the best. Order it and find out why.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.